Okay. Today is April 15th, 2021. I am Janelle Erickson, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Anita May over Zoom about Oklahoma Humanities and her experiences with the organization as a part of Oklahoma Humanities' 50th anniversary project. So thank you for joining me today, Dr. May.
You're welcome.
And to get started, why don't you just tell me a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I'm not from Oklahoma. I was born in Utica, New York, which is in upstate New York, not at all New York City, in the Mohawk Valley, and grew up there and went to Le Moyne College in Syracuse, which is only 50 miles away from Utica. And then I went to the University of Pittsburgh and did both a master's and PhD there in history, and specifically in European history. I got that degree in 1970. I married another graduate student, and he got a position at the University of Oklahoma Health Science Center. And we moved here in 1972, I think. No, wait a minute. We moved here in 1968. That's right. Anyway, for the first couple of years, I was working on a dissertation, which I didn't finish. And as I said, I got my degree in 1970. And so then I was looking for a job, and I got a part-time job at the university, what was then Central State College, actually, now University of Central Oklahoma. And I taught history there. I taught only two classes. It was a part-time position. And first, I taught European history, Western Civ, and then I developed a class in women's history. And I did that till 1974, when I always like to say the bottom fell out of the history market in terms of positions, partly because that was a teacher's college, and the high schools quit requiring history. So we didn't have so many students majoring in history anymore. So there was not a need for faculty, and those people like me who hadn't gone on a tenure track were let go. So I started looking for a position in Oklahoma, because this is where my husband was. And I think you've actually talked with Dr. Levy, who was a friend of ours because of a friend that we knew back in Louisiana. And we met him when we came here, but he knew that I was looking for a position, and he called me and asked me if I wanted to apply to be assistant director at the Oklahoma Humanities Council, it was called then. And so I did apply, and I became the assistant director in 1975, it was. And I did that for about a year. And the director, who was Jim Bohr, who I think you've also interviewed, left to work at the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the council selected me to succeed him. And so I was the director of the humanities, I still call it the Humanities Council, from 1976 until I retired in 2006. And I also taught some part-time. I was visiting lecturer at the University of Central Oklahoma. I also have written numerous articles that were based on my doctoral dissertation, which was in French history. And since I've retired, I have actually published a book which also deals with French history. And that's about it.
Okay.
I guess if you want a personal history, I was married. I am now widowed, and I have two grown children and three grandchildren.
Okay. Yeah, sort of going into more specifics, could you tell me about your experience growing up and sort of your early education going up through high school?
Sure. I was from Utica, New York, as I said, and my background is Italian American, and my parents and grandparents were all good Catholics, and they sent me to Catholic school, and I went to Catholic school, grade school, Catholic high school, and then to that Catholic college in Syracuse, New York. I grew up in a neighborhood that was very Italian American. We had three bakeries and a coffee roaster, and even more importantly, two really wonderful pastry shops, all within walking distance of the home that I grew up in. And until I went to high school, I really didn't know that there were any other people that weren't Italian American. It was only in high school that I started to meet other Catholics, and that was really interesting. I was raised in that Catholic atmosphere, which was quite different from the atmosphere that I, came to deal with in Oklahoma. So a lot of the preconceptions that I had of words like humanities were quite different. Based on that education, I quickly understood what the National Endowment for the Humanities meant by humanities, being what we used to be called the liberal arts, but being history and literature and philosophy and those sorts of disciplines. And I was not at all acquainted with evangelical Christianity from my background in upstate New York. And so I didn't realize that the word humanities meant for a lot of people atheistic humanism. So that was one of the jarring things about my background as opposed to coming here to Oklahoma. But I had a really wonderful education. In high school, I was in the debate club and won some oral, I guess they were, what would they call, speech competitions, and got a grant to go to college, got grants to go to graduate school. And I had parents, I was an only child, and I had parents who really encouraged me to do all that. And they were very proud of all my academic accomplishments, but I was very academically inclined. I loved history from the time I was a little girl, and history was my favorite subject in school. And when I was in grade school, I was a big fan of reading about Abraham Lincoln, and my parents and I went to Washington, D.C., and I think I was about 11 or 12 years old, and I brought them through all the Lincoln sites that are there, the Ford house and the place where Lincoln was taken after he was shot, and the Ford's Theater and the place where Lincoln was taken after he was shot afterwards, and of course the Lincoln Memorial, and we just did all of those things because I was crazy about Abraham Lincoln. But then when I got into college, I really became enthralled with European history. So although I took a lot of American history in college, I loved European history. And when I went to the University of Pittsburgh, I got a National Defense Education Act fellowship to study at that time. It was called Modern Western European History, because it was an act that was passed in the Sputnik era, and the Russians had just put Sputnik up into the atmosphere, and we were very challenged by that and very concerned about keeping European alliances. And so the study of Western Europe was a really big deal. They wanted people to know about Western Europe because that's where our alliances were. So anyway, that was my graduate education was funded by the National Defense Education Act. And so it was very exciting to go from, the smallish, not by Oklahoma standards, there were 100,000 people in the city I grew up in, but it was a small city. In geography, especially, you could walk across the city. I grew up in a very sidewalk-walking city, and when I was in high school, I would meet friends from clear across town walking, and we would walk everywhere. That was kind of the atmosphere. And in the Italian-American community, it was very, very ethnically based. We, just like some of the stories of New York City with the festivals, so the street festivals that they had, and that was common, and two or three of them every year. And so it was really, a typical Northeast. I'm a typical Northeast girl, Northeast United States girl. So it was quite a difference to come to Oklahoma, particularly in 1968 when I came here, because I used to think there were no Italians here, but then subsequently Italian Americans, I found out about all of them in Northeast, I guess it's Eastern Oklahoma, not necessarily Northeastern, around Krebs. But there was certainly there was no semblance of them in Oklahoma City.
Yeah. So did you go to college right out of high school?
Yes, I did the whole thing. I mean, a college, graduate school, right straight through. I didn't take any breaks.
Okay. And when you were in college and got interested in European history, what was it that drew you to that subject?
Well, I don't know. I think it was the revolutions. I think they were fascinating. What caused them? How they continued through the 19th century and all of the turmoil, I think. I mean, we had turmoil in the United States as well, certainly, but for some reason or other, it just seemed more fascinating. Europe seemed more fascinating. And I was particularly attracted to France, maybe because they had the revolution. So that was... that was what did it.
Okay. And I don't know, were there any majorly influential or memorable parts of your college experience?
Well, as I said, I went to a Jesuit college in upstate New York, and it was one of the first Jesuit colleges that allowed women to be liberal arts majors. There, Georgetown had a nursing college, and Maybe some of the others did as well, but no other Jesuit college had women in their regular programs. And but the Archbishop in Syracuse wouldn't let the Jesuits build a college there unless they let women in. So the people that the Jesuit priests who came to teach there were all very open-minded about the possibilities of educating women. And you know, and back in that era, I went to college in 1962. Women were actually told, I was told this, that there were two options for a career for a woman. One was nursing and the other one was teaching school. And I didn't want to teach school. I mean, I didn't want to nurse because I didn't like the sight of blood. So I thought, well, okay, I'll teach. And then I liked history. So I thought I was going to be a history teacher. And then I went to college and I signed up to take the education classes as well as be a history major. And I was extremely bored in the education classes, and I just didn't know what to do with myself because that was the only way to become a teacher. But the dean of women got a whole group of us girls together and told us a different story about opportunities. And one was that if we wanted to teach in college and we could get PhDs. I never even heard of anything like that as a possibility for me. So I was fascinated with that. And then there were lots of people at Le Moyne who were eager and anxious to help us towards that and get scholarships. And I mean, we had whole teams of people working with the people who decided they wanted to go on to graduate school. And so that was, you know, I mean, that was a really supportive atmosphere to be in. I think that changed my life because otherwise I would have, you know, forced myself to take those education classes, I guess, and become a high school teacher. And the first thing I actually wanted to be, though, was a lawyer like Abraham Lincoln. But I was told in no uncertain terms that women were not lawyers. So it was, you know, it was just absolutely a whole different era. And in that era, too, most girls went to college determined to get an MRS instead of anything else. And that was where you were supposed to meet your husband. And many girls in their senior year were determined to get an engagement ring. But I wasn't determined to do that at all. I was determined to get into graduate school. So that's what I did. Anyway, that was my experience in college, but it was really a supportive institution.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that you had support. And so then going on to graduate school, mm-hmm. What was the application process like? And then when you actually got there, sort of, what was the experience there like?
Well, I, you know, the application process wasn't that difficult, I have to say I don't even remember it. I applied to about five or six schools, and I was determined because it was my mother and father were working class people. My father was a welder, and my mother was a hairdresser, and I didn't want to burden them with the price of graduate school, so I was determined to go wherever I got support. And I got full support to go to the University of Pittsburgh. I got a grant from the Washington National Divinity Education that covered my room and board, and then the university waived tuition. And so my parents didn't have to pay anything for my graduate education. The one thing that was I always felt was too bad about the fact that it was what it was, is that I didn't get any teaching experience in graduate school because I had just this completely free ride. And then at the end of the NDA, my department had Andrew Mellon fellowships to complete your dissertation, and I got one of those to the end. So I never taught a class until I came here to Oklahoma and taught at University of Central Oklahoma, or Central State College, as it was called then. So that was one of the detriments of being so fully supported as I was, and because a lot of my friends and fellow students were teaching classes or at least assisting professors and grading and stuff like that. I never had any of that.
Yeah. And so could you tell me about what the transition of moving to Oklahoma was like?
Well, my husband I finished my degree at the University of Pittsburgh kind of long distance because my husband transferred with his major professor down to Tulane University, and we lived in New Orleans for 3 years before we came here. And there was a man who had come to Tulane when my husband was there, and he was a doctor at OU Health Science Center, and he wanted to start a history of medicine program. And he was studying, that was my husband's field, with this man who was really eminent in the history of medicine at Tulane, who had been at Pittsburgh. His name was John Duffy. And so he came down there to study with John Duffy, met my husband, and offered him a job here in Oklahoma to help him start that program. And so we came here. When we got here, it was so different from every place I had ever been. It was much more suburban. You know, there was a real car culture here. The wife of this man told me that when she came, she was wheeling a stroller, and a car drove slowly by her and asked her if she needed a ride because he had never seen anybody walking that didn't have to walk because their car had broken down. So, I mean, even that was so different from anything. So when I came, I was completely nonplussed, but we adapted somehow. He was busy, and I was looking for work, and I found this it was part-time position at Central State College, and I started teaching up there. And I already had one child, and I had a second one before I finished teaching there, before I went to work for the Humanities Council. I got used to it, but it was totally different to have to get in a car to go everywhere. And then I didn't quite understand anything about Oklahoma. But I just, you know, did my little teaching gig and that sort of thing. And then when I took this job with the humanities, I learned about Oklahoma so quickly. And it was so fascinating because at that time, we went all over the state to attend programs that we funded. And it was fascinating. I had this story that at that time there was a song called Okie from Muskogee, which gives you a pretty I don't know what to call it, a vision of Oklahoma people as being certainly unsophisticated and certainly not very interested in something like the humanities. And one of the first programs that I ever went to was at the Muskogee Public Library, where they were discussing this program that we had at the time. It was called Limits to Freedom, which was about censorship. And I went to this library in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and I found out that the song wasn't true. Anyway, it was very interesting to meet all the people that I met doing that job. I'm board members, but also the people in the communities who were so determined to have public programs in their towns, and so dedicated. They were all volunteers, primarily, except for the librarian or the person in the museum or something. So it was fascinating.
Yeah. So next, I'd like to ask you to sort of explain what the National Endowment for the Humanities is.
Oh, well, the National Endowment for the Humanities was started in, I think, the 1969 or 65, I forget now, 69 or 65, you probably find that out. And it's got some tremendous sounding documents which say, a great nation needs this. And and it was founded to support the humanities, and they define the humanities as history, literature, philosophy, and etc. As I said, that was a difficult thing to explain to a lot of people, because that had not been the common usage. I mean, when I went to college, these disciplines were called the liberal arts. And then when I was in graduate school, actually, the history department, which I was in, was more affiliated with social sciences than it was with the humanities. And there were people in history, professors in history, who saw history as much more of a science than an art. So I always say that the National Endowment for the Humanities was created a little bit too late to really save the humanities from where they have become now. I think if you look at colleges and universities, and they've sort of gone towards career education. And so even something like English is called communicate. I mean, they're still an English major, but people don't often major in English anymore. They major in communications, because that's going to get them a job. And history is, just like not something that's a breadwinning job anymore. And so that's the way people have looked at it. So when they founded the National Endowment for the Humanities, there was this push to, get the humanities more appreciated in public. So the first thing they did was to sponsor really some large programs. But when they created state councils, which I think was an experiment that was founded in early 1970s, they didn't think that the general public would be interested in the humanities unless it bore on a specific public issue. So And when I came in, and from its beginning, you had to make your program up to explore public issues. So we did a lot of programs about, at that time, the Equal Rights Amendment and things like censorship and public issues, because they were convinced that that the general public would not be interested in anything that, you know, things like history and English literature and stuff like that were studied in school. And then once you got out of school, you didn't want to hear about it. And what we found out in doing state programs was that actually one of the things that you could count on an audience for were history programs. People love history. They just do. And they were not, you know, maybe they didn't know that they loved history when they were in school, but our history programs were the most popular programs that we had. And in particular, Oklahoma history. I was thinking about this morning when I was thinking about what I would tell you. And I was trying to think, what were our most popular programs? Where were the crowds? When would we fill the audience? And it was for the Chautauqua programs. The Chautauqua programs were scholars in the humanities portrayed historical figures in costume, but they would be very faithful to the writings and documents that were involved in that person's life. And we pitched tents. the sponsors would pitch a tent, and all the programs were under a large tent. And then during the day, there were like seminars on different topics. And it was modeled on the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York. And I'd never gone. When I grew up in upstate New York, it's expensive to go. My parents didn't take me there. But 2 years ago, before the pandemic, the summer before the pandemic, I got to go to the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York for a week. And these programs, which a friend of mine in North Dakota, it was the one that originated the model for state humanities councils, were exactly patterned after what they do upstate New York. They do have a big tent, it's much more permanent than a pitch tent, but they have programs all day long, and then some big programs in which they draw a full tent. So our programs were similar, except that at the Chautauqua Institution, which was founded back in the 19th century, there weren't people impersonating historical figures. They were the historical figures, like William Jennings Bryan was there. So many of the figures that we read about in American history spoke at the Chautauqua Institution. But those were our most popular programs. And the next most popular programs were anything that we did about Oklahoma history. And our exhibit programs were also very popular, especially when they dealt with Oklahoma history. So the NEH was wrong when they thought that people would only be interested in history if it was about a public policy. But they learned, and it was about 4 years or 3 or 4 years after I took the job in 1975 that they allowed us to do programs about anything we wanted to do them about. So anyway.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah. And the, you can go.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to ask that as the, National Endowment for the Humanities was like being created and getting founded sort of, mm-hmm. if you recall what like public opinion about it was as it was being created.
Well, you know, I can't speak to the national experience. I can only speak to the Oklahoma experience, because I have to tell you that it was relatively new. So we moved here, as I explained to you, in 1968. And my husband was on the faculty, and he was in the humanities, but in the Health Science Center. So he was asked to participate in some of these early programs, which, of course, were about public policy and were about policies about health, right? And so he was in them. I had never heard of any of this until my husband participated in those programs. I didn't know about the National Endowment for the Humanities or anything like that when I was here. But then that's not too odd because, you know, I was in graduate school and then and just popped out of, you know, going down the rabbit hole of doing a doctoral dissertation. And so I probably wouldn't hear about it, but they probably didn't also have much of a national exposure. But here in Oklahoma, with the State Humanities Council, there were people that were very suspicious of the fact that it was a government program. You may know this from growing up in Texas, but as well, but there is lots of suspicion of government control, and you can hear that, you know, everything now. We don't want the government to control this or that or the other thing. And so our organization was suspicioned for being a government program. There was a state arts council, but that was less suspicious because it was a state program, even though it was funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. It was matched at the state level, and it was a state program as far as people were concerned. So I don't think they had quite as much a suspicion about them, but knowing that it was federally funded somehow or other, it would be suspected. And then here in Oklahoma, there was, as I said in the beginning, the word humanities. As I said, I didn't know a thing about it. For me, being educated in the humanities, the word humanities harkened back to Erasmus. And that's the way I learned about humanities in history, was that in the, I guess it would have been the 16th century, 15th, 16th century, there was the Renaissance, and there were scholars that were hearkening back to Greece and Rome and the more secular philosophies, but certainly not atheistic. There was nothing atheistic about Erasmus or Thomas More or any of the people that were leaders in this intellectual Renaissance. And so I was completely nonplussed that there was this idea that humanism was atheistic, but the word humanities was used with the name of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and we used it here, first as Humanities Task Force and then as Humanities Committee, I guess it was called. But that word was offensive to so many people. And then to make matters worse, the endowment called scholars in history, literature, philosophy, et cetera, humanists, which, I mean, at the time, I don't know if it's still true, you could hear evangelical preachers speak against humanists. And so anyway, but what did I know, right? And so I was trying to get more grants to the smaller towns, and we weren't, because we weren't getting projects from the smaller towns. And so the first year that I was with the Humanities Council, we created this summer residency program for scholars who would work with a local library or a museum or something to present, develop a public program and present it that summer. And we called it the Summer Humanist Project. We advertised it and we did get applications because people who were running libraries and other institutions locally were interested in having what you might call educational programs for the public in their communities. So anyway, there was a woman who came into my office representing someone who was a friend of hers from one of the towns that we had given a grant to. And this person was worried about the word humanist. And she came in a little bit huffy. And I was on the telephone when she came in. And at the time, the National Endowment for the Humanities had sponsored this exhibit on Egyptian archaeology, and it featured Tutankhamun. And so I had this giant poster of Tutankhamun in my office, and she was sitting in my office and waiting for me to get off the telephone. And then when I got off the telephone, she looked at me and she said, "Is this about culture?" And I said, "Yes, it's about culture." And she said, "Well, I'm in favor of culture." And I said, "Oh, good." And she said, "Well, you know," and then she explained to me that this friend of hers had been worried that we were going to preach atheism through that whatever program it was that we had. And then so she gave him the green light because actually it was about culture. So that was what we dealt with originally. And then very soon, this was must have been happening in other states too, that the humanities, National Endowment for the Humanities, quit using the word humanism and humanist because it was not going anywhere. So anyway, but that was part of the deal. And then we actually had a town where the library refused the grant because they were afraid that it was preaching atheism. And the scholar who was the person who was leading the project for the local institution was actually an ordained minister in his first calling. And then he had gotten a PhD in history and was teaching in some college or other. And so it was absolutely ludicrous, but this organization in town had raised such a challenge to the library that the library refused the grant ultimately. And then there was an article in that local newspaper in which the journalist said, I think, I don't know how many grants we gave that summer, but I think there were at least 10. He said, you know, 9 other communities took this money and did some programming, but we turned it down. Anyway, but those were some of the early challenges doing this in Oklahoma, between the fact that we don't like federal programs for some reason or other, and then the word humanist was between the two things. It was a challenge. And my former the man who hired me, Jim Vore, said that his friend who opened the office in California was solicited for grants when he took a taxi cab, and here in Oklahoma we had to go out and sort of introduce the word and convince people that we were all right and we weren't some kind of group that was going around the state trying to make everybody atheistic. So anyway, but those were the early challenges. The other thing that I think we then had huge success with is when we started, we had our own traveling exhibit program. And when people would host an exhibit, then they could see this was about history or this was about, you know, and it was there in pictorial form for them to look at and see, you know, this is not about not believing in God.
Yeah. But, yeah. And so next, you've mentioned a few times the state councils for this. So could you tell me about the state council model for local National Endowment of the Humanities, like state affiliations?
Well, it grew from those early days. There were just five state councils, and then it grew gradually to have a council in every one of the territories. And it was like, there was a sense of mission that is really, it may still be there, but it isn't there the way it was in the beginning, where we were creating something brand new to bring public programming to the general public. It was new and it was exciting, and for some of us it was harder than others. And we very early on we started having national meetings where we met each other and talked to each other about programs that we developed that were successful. So we got a lot of stimulation from each other and encouragement from each other. And we also had regional meetings, group of people in the Western states were especially active in a Western humanities regional meeting. And the thing that was really interesting about it, and my husband was more of a sociologist than he was a historian, he's talk about the evolution of institutions. And there was this absolute sense of, creating something new and a mission. And also the other interesting thing about the people who created these programs initially is that almost to a person, we were people who had gotten PhDs or in some instances only master's degrees and expected to teach in college. And then, as I say, the bottom fell out of that when people turned to more practical majors and you didn't have a lot of need for professors in history, literature, and philosophy. So we couldn't find jobs. So most everyone in these positions at first were people who would have gone to teach in college. And we were all about the same age too. I was like 35 when I took the job, and just about everybody else was 35. I mean, or younger. There were just a few people who were older. And there was a pretty good representation of women in the program too. It wasn't dominated by men. I'm talking about executive directors now. And so it was pretty unique in all of those ways, almost, and it was considered experimental. The endowment considered it experimental too. And I always say that it started in states where they actually thought it wasn't going to work. And it worked really well. And it worked especially well in states like Oklahoma, where there wasn't a lot of cultural activity going on, particularly in the smaller towns, that there wasn't the encouragement and support for that. And I know when I look back at the town that I grew up in, I saw that there was so much more activity in that town than I remember growing up because of the New York Humanities Council. And so it was kind of interesting to look at that too. So because I didn't grow up here, so I didn't know that well, but I knew very well what happened in the town I grew up in, and there wasn't that activity there. And then subsequently there was. So anyway, it's a marvelous experiment that turned out to be really successful. And it was threatened very many times. I don't know if you want to go into that or not, but nationally it was threatened with a lack of support. But anyway.
Yeah. So what was sort of the initial purpose of trying out these state level councils for the humanities organizations?
Well, the purpose was, you know, the Congress funded it, right? And so originally, the National Endowment for the Humanities, as far as, you know, and this may be biased by influence of State Humanities Council thinking, but originally, as I understand it, the National Endowment for the Humanities thought it was going to be fine for them to give grants nationally, and they didn't have to worry about giving grants at the state level. But as you can tell about my story about California, the people with the biggest institutions in the country were the ones that very quickly gobbled up money from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And then they also have research grants and that sort of thing, not just public programs. There's a public program division, but we were in public programs, and if the research division that went national right away, and who's to say that shouldn't be national? That was their preserve, but in terms of grants in public programming, you know, the National Endowment was giving some absolutely blockbuster museum grants, like I told you about the Tutankhamun, which appeared in several large cities, not Oklahoma City, I'm saying. So, but then you've got it in it. You've got this program and they're putting money in it, and the people putting money in it are from all different states, right? And they're saying to the National Endowment for the Humanities, we think that, you know, this ought to be going to our states too. So the only way that was going to happen is if they created some state presence. And the first, the National Endowment for the Arts created that quickly. But the National Endowment for the Humanities had doubts, as I said, about whether or not random people would be interested in the humanities. So that's why they started it a little at a time. And they picked, experimentally, they picked different kinds of institutions. So our council was placed with the State Arts Council first. I don't know if anybody's explained that yet, but one was placed with like a continuing education school, and one was independent, and one was with some other kind of institution. But just to see which ones would work the best, and they decided after a small amount of time that it was the ones that were independent that were working the best. So that's how it came to be. But it was very experimental. They didn't know if it would work or not. And but the people funding the thing, the Congress members, wanted it to go to the states and were upset that, you know, they were just going to the bigger cities, etc. So that's how in my opinion, that's how it came to have a distribution in each state.
Okay. Could you explain the like sort of like tying in with the Art Council that you just mentioned?
Well, I don't know a lot about that. Jim Bohr was there. I wasn't. When I came in, we were independent. I had no experience of the tie-in with the Arts Council. I just know it historically. And for a long time, I think there was a feeling that the State Arts Council resented losing the program because, you know, in the great bureaucracy that we have in this country and in the state, you know, every state organization wants as much power as it can get, you know, so state agency. And so Jim always thought that, it seemed to me that Jim always thought that they missed having it, but I never particularly experienced that. He can speak more to that.
Okay. Yeah. So now I think I'd like to talk about your experience coming on as a member of the Oklahoma Humanities Council. So how did you, what's the story behind your initial application and joining of the organization?
Oh, well, as I explained to you, I didn't know about it. I didn't know there was a position advertised or anything like that. And it's really because of my husband's and my friendship with David Levy that I heard about it. And so I was actually applying to schools. I was willing to go teach in lower division, you know, high school. And at the time, because I wanted to work, so I was busy doing that when I had applied for some university positions, but they were out of state. So when this came up, it was easier because my husband had a job here to say, well, okay, I'll apply for that. And but I had no idea what I was getting into, honest to God. I was thinking about that too. So I had my interview with Jim Bohr, and he offered me the job right away. And then there I was, and, you know, I learned about some of the big initiatives like this Limits to Freedom program that they were doing. And but he was so tired out from starting the thing, because I think it was started back in 71 and this is 75. And he wanted to take a sabbatical, and that's what they offered, sabbaticals, as if it was an academic position. So I wasn't in there for more than a few months before he took a sabbatical and left me to run this thing that I didn't know much about. It was a baptism by fire. And but at the National Endowment for the Humanities, there were really very few states and very helpful program officers. It wasn't like later when program officers couldn't be that involved because they had too many states. Well, now they didn't have that many states. And so he not only left, but I had to write the proposal to the National Endowment for the Humanities for the next year's funding. And it was this man who was my program officer at the National Endowment for the Humanities, and David Levy, who I told had to help me out because he got me into this, that helped me write that proposal for the next funding. And so we did it. And I, you know, it was really difficult because there I was brand new, but it was I learned about everything because everything they had done before and everything because I had to. So, anyway, you never know what you can do until you're faced with having to do it. So I did write that proposal with everybody's help, and then he came back, and he was only there for about, oh, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 more months, not before he went to the National Endowment for the Humanities for a job up there. But I had survived all that, and the chairman at the time knew it. He was a big fan of mine, and he found out from equal rights coordinator at the University of Oklahoma that it would be fine to promote a woman. I think he was a little too lazy to do a job search. So he told the board that he wanted to promote me to be the director. So that's really how I got the job as director. I applied for the assistant director job, but the chairman at the time, Paige Mulholland, decided that if his equal rights coordinator at the university told him it was all right to promote a woman, that he was just going to promote a woman. And then it was my problem to find an assistant director, and he didn't have to do that, you know? So anyway, that's how I got to be the director of the Humanities Council. But as I said, you know, everything was experimental. And so none of us knew what we were doing. We invented public programming in the humanities because nobody was really doing it. The universities would have programs, but they would be for their own, students, not for anybody else. It wasn't like, I mean, I think universities were obviously doing plays and things like that, but even that wasn't marketed to a public audience so much, you know, as it is even more now. But the whole idea, and then, as I said, finding institutions to do things. And then once we got rid of the public policy focus, we brought on a lot more people. Like the museums didn't want to do much programming about public policy, and they were more interested in things like art history and stuff. So we had more people interested in doing public programs with our grants. I think actually growing out of our success with public libraries and the Limits to Freedom program, one of my colleagues in Vermont invented this thing called Let's Talk About It, which is reading discussion programs in public libraries on themes that are devised by scholars in the humanities. And so we started that program here in Oklahoma. And if you look at the programs of the Oklahoma Humanities now, Let's Talk About It is one of the most common programs in public libraries in the state. And that's literature and history and philosophy and everything else in those books that they read, you know. So they're introduced by scholars in the humanities, and discussions are monitored by the humanities scholars, and so it's just a lovely program, and it is extremely popular, as you can tell just by looking at the website.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so when you got promoted to the executive director position, what sort of like duties and expectations did you have in that role?
Well, as I said, it was something that we were inventing. I mean, I actually invented everything that I I did with the help of my colleagues in the other states. I mean, we invented the initiatives that we were doing, and part of it was, you know, going out and introducing the humanities to people. We used to do regular visits to get people in for meetings and stuff like that to introduce the whole concept of doing programs, and then introducing what are the humanities anyway, and that was a lot of the initial job, and of course a lot of it was something that I didn't know a thing about, which was managing budgets and accounting and stuff like that. I learned on the job, and I learned it from some of the accountants that I dealt with. I didn't know a thing about that. And by the program officers at the National Endowment for the Humanities, who were really helpful. And then after a while, we weren't getting enough federal money. I had to learn about fundraising. And I think it was at the beginning of the Reagan administration when we theoretically we were going to get axed completely. We never did that, but getting funding was very perilous, and we realized that we weren't going to get as much as, you know, the kind of increases that had been happening before then, and so we started to have to fundraise. So then my job was to learn about fundraising. So I did so many things in this position that I never, you know, was trained when I got a PhD to do. But you know, one of my board members ran the College of Liberal Studies at University of Oklahoma. And one time when I first started needing somebody to do public relations work and promotion, I was looking for, I started looking for journalism majors because I thought they would be the most likely people. And I found in interviewing journalism majors that I wasn't finding people who were well-rounded enough to even talk with, and I didn't think they'd do a good job promoting our programs, which were so diverse, and they didn't have the depth of understanding to do it. And this man said to me, the dean of the College of Liberal Studies said to me, "Oh, don't look at anything like that." He said, "You get a humanities major." in that job, and then you know, have them do publicity. So the first person who took the job was actually a person who was an English major, and he had worked at a newspaper, and that's pretty much what I used after that, is that I got the people who majored in English rather than the people who majored in anything specific to, you know, like job prep. And I firmly believe that you learn that a broader education is the best preparation for any position. And even in business, and the maybe not so much in science, but I think that the humanities teach imagination and creativity that if you're just schooled for a career, you don't have.
Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to ask that whenever you got promoted to the executive director position, were there any sort of like goals that you had for the organization that you want to achieve while you're in your position?
I had this vision, you know, because I came to Oklahoma, that sports were on everybody's lips, and I had it's not so true in upstate New York that every school has a football team and goes out and roots for it. My husband was from Texas, and so he did a lot of explaining about this. But every town, and you may know that from growing up in Texas, has a football team, and they're all wrapped around what happens to that school football team. And he told me, he was from Beeville, Texas, and he said that the coach would be invited to the Chamber of Commerce meeting and explain if the football team was losing, what was wrong with the football team. And finally, this coach said to the Chamber of Commerce meeting, he says, what's wrong with football in Beeville is the people who asked the question, what's wrong with football in Beeville? So, I mean, but it was so important that, it was what occupied people. So it was my ambition to have as many public programs in Oklahoma as there were high school football games. That was my ambition. And that meant, of course, to get programming in all kinds of little towns all over the state. And I think I did that with both the Let's Talk About It and the Chautauqua programs. I had programs all over the state. And then the traveling exhibits, and maybe not as many as I never reached probably the number of football games, but at least that was my goal.
Yeah, that's a pretty fun measuring stick for the success of the program.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I believe in setting goals that are high, right?
Yeah,
but
might as well.
That was my ambition, to have programs all over, everywhere. And I think we made it. We do a lot in cities that are very amazing that there's a program there. And a lot of people learned a lot about Oklahoma history from our programs. And then we had some really nice blockbuster programs that people came from a lot of different places to see. And that's pretty much still going on. So I think that we did a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think for this interview, this might be a good stopping point.